everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of Are You Kidding Me? I'm Naomi Schaefer Riley, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Today, my colleague Ian Rowe is off, but we are thrilled to be joined here at Are You Kidding Me? By Eva Moskowitz. She is, as many of you probably already know, the founder and CEO of Success Academy Charter Schools in New York. And most recently, she is the author of a new book called A Plus Parenting, The Surprisingly Fun Guide to Raising Surprisingly Smart Kids. Thanks so much for joining us, Eva.
Thanks for having me, Naomi.
So this is a little bit of a diversion for you, or maybe not at all, from your work in the field of professional education. So I guess just start by telling us why you decided to write this book.
Yeah, and my worlds of parenting and schooling have over the years sort of intersected in the sense that a lot of my ideas about parenting, for example, the criticality of playing games is in the school. So all of our kids take chess as a subject, and we play games from backgammon to blockus to Monopoly, Settlers of Catan in school. So there's ways in which schooling has impacted my parenting and parenting has impacted the schooling. But my husband and I have three children. And about 2 years ago, we became empty nesters. And perhaps we wrote the book nostalgically, I don't know. But we did think that if we were going to write a book on parenting, we probably needed to do it soon before it became a sort of distant memory. And, you know, I remember, you know, all the books that you can buy on, you know, expecting and pregnancy, mm-hmm. all the books you can buy on toilet training your kids or how you deal with a temper tantrum. And yet raising intellectual children, you actually can't find a book on. How do you make sure that your children are thoughtful, you know, understand how to receive diversity of opinion, how to navigate as critical thinkers? It was actually a missing part of the market. And yet many parents that I was talking to, both from the schooling world, but also my personal life, were kind of struggling with, you know, how to academically prepare your children, or sort of the getting into college rat race and what is important. Mm-hmm. And so my husband and I thought that maybe providing parents a bit of a roadmap might be helpful. And it's not a philosophical book, although it has some philosophy in it. It's really a how-to book.
Yeah, it's very self-helpy. It was a surprisingly fun book. But I wanted to ask you, so a lot of the things that you just mentioned, just sort of the academic preparedness of kids, I think a lot of people just automatically think that those kinds of preparations are the responsibility of schools, not parents, teaching critical thinking and even the way that you talk about games, that there are ways of that teachers, professionals really need to engage in these things. So, you know, one of the arguments that, you know, I think is very wise, you point out, is that obviously parents spend a lot more time with their kids than schools do. So that's important. But how do you think parents should or could sort of do this differently from schools?
Well, and I say this, of course, as a dedicated school leader, I think it's a little dangerous just to leave it up to the school, as good as the schools may be, and some are good and some are less good. But, you know, I think really showing your kids what is excellent poetry, or what are the I consider film sort of the greatest art form of the 20th century. What are the great films and why are they great? You know, they're not necessarily going to see the canon in their school. Maybe they will, but, you know, I show the kids silent films at Success Academy, but not every school does.
I would bet, yeah.
So your kids can miss out a lot if you don't, kind of curate and direct that learning. I also think, and this may be my personal perspective, but I think a lot of parents feel an obligation to just sort of get down to the kids' level. And my husband and I always took the approach, well, kids might only understand 25% of a discussion about the Middle East or a discussion about Casablanca, but 25% is better than nothing. And since we were interested in movies and lyrics and poetry, it makes parenting a lot more enjoyable if you can do things that you really like. And it's quite infectious for children. They come to like those activities when you do it as part of your family time.
So I was really interested in some of the particular recommendations that you were making, things like listening to Tom Lehrer songs, things like that. And one of the reasons that it struck me was that when I went to college, I remember there were a couple of, really smart people that I met there. And who just sort of had this very wide-ranging knowledge of the world, like more so than a lot of other college students. And one of the defining characteristics was that they listened to Tom Lehrer songs. But there were a couple of things like that that came up in the book. And I wonder if you could kind of talk about, you said that there were parents who were in your schools who asked you about parenting and writing this book, maybe even. Can you talk about kind of the class issues here? Like, I mean, a lot of the parents in your schools are coming from working class backgrounds. They might not have, in their own childhood have, done the things that you're talking about. Who is the audience for the book? And, are you hoping to kind of bridge a little bit of that divide that, seems to be happening more and more in America between sort of people who understand all these cultural references because they were taught them at home and people who don't?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is that divide or divergence, often, the people who've heard of Lehrer are limited in sort of scope. But, our kids play chess. We have 11,000 kids playing chess. And, we do provide opportunities for parents to learn the game. Frankly, their kids quickly surpass them just because they're taking it as a subject 5 days a week and they're competing, et cetera. Not always. But it can be a good experience for your six-year-old to beat you. That's not the end of the world. So there are some things that are easier to access. We provide our parents who are mostly poor with poetry that most, not all, can read to their kids. And by the way, if they're not literate, we have audio of the poetry being read by professional readers, which can be great no matter what class you're in, because they're quite skilled in their reading. So, we try and provide for a diverse audience. And I do think that the angst that comes with being a parent, are you doing enough for your kids? Is there more you could be doing? Are you doing too much for your kids? These are questions that tend to plague people of a variety of classes. Mm-hmm. And one of the messages in the book is, don't forget to enjoy it. And what you find enjoyable as an adult is something that your kids will remember the joy that you bring to the parenting. We almost called the book The Joy of Parenting, but decided that that didn't quite get the intellectual development message.
So you talk in the book about, particularly when you're kind of picking reading for the kids, There is this very popular notion that as long as a kid is reading, that's all that we, you know, need. And so they could be reading The Wimpy Kid, or they could be reading comic books or whatever. It doesn't really matter. But you take a very different approach to that. Can you sort of describe how you recommend picking books for kids to read?
Well, I've saved parents the trouble because I have an index of books. And look, as the founder and CEO of Success Academy, I would say if there's one thing that I've probably spent the most amount of time on is reading children's books and really curating, because you can have, you know, really powerful illustrations and texts of incredible literary merit, and you can have schlock, and you need to distinguish between those. And it's hard as a parent, particularly a working parent. You may not have time to, you know, read through hundreds of children's books and distinguish. I do think that the, you know, literary competitions do give you some guidance. So if it's a Newbery Book Award winner, it is probably a very strong choice. Mm-hmm. But we've tried to provide books for parents so that they're not wondering. But, you know, good poetry sparks insights and provokes the senses and does all sorts of things that maybe a Hallmark card would not. And so, you know, you want to be particular about what you put in front of the kids.
Right. I was also interested in your recommendations about movies. And I was wondering whether you could maybe give an example here, you know, of kind of the movies that you think are worthwhile for kids to watch, and in particular, why? Because I think, you know, there are lots of, actually for parents, it's probably easier to find movies that they find kind of decent and appropriate than say TV shows or other forms of entertainment. But you have some very, you know, kind of particular movie recommendations. And I just wonder if you could kind of explain your rationale.
Sure. And they range. I'm a big fan of Tom and Jerry. That's a series that I think, you know, has a lot of internal jokes. And I think, you know, kids getting wit is one of the more intellectual muscles being exercised. And so I found that my kids just found Tom and Jerry hilarious. I mean, tears rolling down their cheeks, laughter. And they would endlessly discuss it, even though my eldest is 6 years older than my youngest. It was something that all three kids, you know, once Hannah reached the age of, I don't know, my youngest 5 or 6, they would discuss it endlessly. And so, you know, it's not just showing the movie, it's the post-movie discussion that is actually really, really important. I love silent movies. I think they are underutilized in education generally, and I would argue in parenting. Again, it goes back to this wit and making of meaning. I also teach wordless books in our school because pre-reading can occur by making meaning. So wordless books are books that have no words, but just pictures. And kids have to tell the story without the words. And that storytelling muscle is very foundational to being able to read, even though it doesn't involve reading in the classic sense. So silent movies generally have some sort of subtitle, but the subtitle is very short. And what is going on in the film is much larger than the subtitle. And so the amount of responsibility, if you will, or the onus is on the kid. So I love Charlie Chaplin silent films. I like Harold Lloyd. I, of course, love Buster Keaton. these are just really funny films.
You have a section of the book where you talk a little bit about movies that have sort of very obvious kind of moral lessons, and then movies that have, or just stories generally that have kind of more subtle lessons that leave people, kind of wondering, and they don't always end with the good guy winning or things like that. And, again, you seem to be sort of encouraging parents to, have their children reach a little higher, or think a little bit harder about some of these things, as opposed to the culture that seems to, sort of more spoon feed a lot of the information and lessons to kids. How do you know, when these things are appropriate, and how whether too much is going over their head, I guess, is one question.
I mean, you try it, and by the way, when you have kids who are 6 years apart, kids have different levels of access, and but I think the point is really an important one, that so many Hollywood films today have an unambiguous moral ending, and life is full of ambiguity, and humankind is complex, and we all have very good qualities, but we also have flaws. And kids confronting the moral complexity is actually hard for kids. They want my kids at the beginning, like they wanted a good guy and a bad guy. And sometimes the good guy or good woman had flaws. And sometimes the villain had some appealing characteristics. And that's actually challenging for children. And initially, my kids, and this is when they're, a little older, 14, 15, they get mad at the movies. Why couldn't the director just kind of make it clear? Why do we have to debate what happened here and what the meaning is and the complexity? And I think that sort of stage one is you get mad at the director for giving you a morally ambiguous ending or moment. But as your kids get older, they actually appreciate the sophistication of that ambiguity and how engaging it is to think about what not only the movie is saying, but what might be the application to life.
So obviously you're pretty carefully curating what your kids can watch. Can we talk a little bit about cell phones and kind of social media? Because there are kind of a few places. The book is mostly I recommendations for things that you should and could do with your kids. But you take a pretty hard line about cell phones and sort of social media and just a lot of kind of the junk that's on screens now. And I wonder if you could kind of just explain, why you sort of draw this hard line there.
And I do feel very, very strongly that kids, probably around the world, but I'm most familiar with the American context, are spending on average 6 hours a day on their phone. It could be TikTok, it could be Instagram, it could be YouTube, and I'm sure there are new ones every day that I'm not familiar with. And I do think it's troubling because that is curated and packaged in a highly market segmentation way, and developers of content are playing back to kids what they know they want to hear or preying on their demographic. So you have young girls who are, moving in the opposite direction of, some of the accomplishments of the feminist movement, where they want to change the look of their face, and can actually do so using social media so that they get an image that they're happy with. I think that is quite negative. And we would be better off with kids reading and playing with other kids and not doing everything through a digital medium.
Do you think that, first let me ask you, so I assume that there are no phones allowed in your schools or certainly not in the classrooms. Do you have the kids sort of check them someplace at the beginning of the day?
Yeah. K-8, and believe it or not, second graders can have phones. I wasn't expecting that early on, but so we have a bin and it must be in the bin for the entire day. In high school, it's a little different. The kids are allowed to have them, and there are very specific times when they can use them, but we do let them carry them on them. If they violate the policies, then their phone is kept at the main office until the end of the day.
So just a last sort of question, which is maybe about the joy aspect of the book. There are a lot of parents these days who feel like parenting is not much fun. There's kind of an enormous amount of complaining from every realm. And there are folks who say, well, you know, kind of our culture has made parenting no fun. Our laws have made parenting no fun. What would your sort of recommendation be for, you know, parents who are kind of looking to reclaim some of the joy? I mean, obviously you have a lot of, you know, specific books and things like that, but, you know, what is the way to engage with your kids or engage in parenting that can help us, you know, maybe refine some of the happiness that maybe used to be more part of parenting or that we thought was going to be a part of parenting before we started it?
Yes. And look, you know, it is challenging with, you know, two working parents and stresses that kids are under and the college rat race and the scheduling. You know, you want your kid to experience their passions, whether it's playing the violin or soccer, but that involves a lot of transport and a lot of activities for the parent that they might not have exactly signed up for, being a soccer mom or whatever it is. But nonetheless, I would still say that the parent is the locus of control. And if you want to enjoy parenting, then, you know, enjoy it and don't let things get in your way. I get it's stressful and I get your kids can be under stress. But, you know, family time is still family time, and maybe we all have less of it. You know, I certainly did with, you know, working many, many hours. But I still did activities with my kids. I still played with them. I still read to them. You know, those are cherished moments. We still play charades. We did play charades and we still play charades. We did play password and we're still playing password. So you can enjoy it very simply. And I would not let anything get in the way of enjoying it. But I think to enjoy it, you have to feel somewhat entitled to it, meaning you're not there as a parent just to serve your kids. Of course, you have the obligation to raise them, but you can get something out of it too. It can be a shared experience. And in my personal opinion, your kids will enjoy it more when you get something out of it, when it's not just for them. It's you're doing it because you want to do the scientific experiment. You want to read the poem. You want to see the movie. And you have views and opinions about the movie or the song. And so I think it just needs to be reclaimed.
All right. Well, those are all the questions we have for you, Eva. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been another episode of Are You Kidding Me? I'm Naomi Schaefer Riley. You can get episodes of this podcast at the AEI podcast channel or wherever you get your podcasts. And we will be back soon with Ian Rowe returning. So never fear. Thanks again, Eva.
Thank you.